I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the Weekly Review, should President Obama grant clemency to Jonathan Pollard? He was sentenced to life nearly three decades ago for spying for Israel. The Pollard case has connections to Maryland and Baltimore. It surfaces from time to time, and this week it became part of Secretary of State John Kerry's efforts to keep alive the fraying Israel-Palestine peace negotiations. Today, we'll speak to University of Baltimore law professor Kenneth Lassen about Jonathan Pollard. Kenneth Lassen has championed Pollard's release, arguing that his punishment was too harsh. He joins us in the coming hour. We'll also hear commentary from historian Richard Striner on the Supreme Court decision on money and election campaigns. It's Midday Friday. First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. After dropping two out of three games to the Boston Red Sox at Camden Yards, the Orioles head to Detroit for a weekend of games with the Tigers. While the baseball birds are away, what about the real Baltimore Orioles, the ones with feathers? Later this hour, we'll hear about the Baltimore Oriole and where and when you might see its orange and black flash in Maryland this spring. Plus, urban birding and how Baltimore's Patterson Park figures in the migrations of all kinds of birds. That's coming up at the end of this hour. Between now and then, we'll have a visit from Kenneth Lassen, law professor at the University of Baltimore, and an advocate for the release from federal prison of Jonathan Pollard, the former U.S. Navy intelligence analyst who was sentenced to life for spying for Israel in the 1980s. The Pollard case was back in the news this week with a report that the Obama administration was considering offering to release Pollard, something supported by Israel, as a bargaining point in the shaky Israel-Palestine peace negotiations. We'll be joined by Kenneth Lassen in just a few minutes. First, we review some of the news of the week as we discussed earlier on Midday. Monday was the deadline for the first health insurance enrollment under the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature domestic achievement that won congressional approval in 2010 without a single Republican vote. Close to 10 million Americans, including nearly 300,000 Marylanders, have gained new or improved health plans under the ACA so far. But congressional Republicans vowed again this week to continue to try and repeal the act. In fact, on Tuesday, Paul Ryan, the Republican chairman of the House Budget Committee, and Mitt Romney's running mate in 2012, he presented a plan that trims spending by $5 trillion over the next decade with steep cuts to Medicaid and food stamps, and including the total repeal of the Affordable Care Act. In fact, his budget counts on that. The Ryan budget would increase defense spending while reducing domestic programs to historically low levels. So, look at the landscape. Predictions of a massive fail in the Obamacare rollout turned out to be premature, if not completely wrong, though Republicans continue to call it a disaster. They vow its repeal just as millions are reaping the benefits of the law. We have a midterm election in the fall, with some political analysts predicting that Republicans will gain a majority in the Senate, maintain a majority in the House, while calling for more austerity, just as more Americans see the benefits of the most ambitious federal program in nearly half a century. Okay, some perspective on all of this now from Richard Striner, professor of history at Washington College in Chestertown and a regular contributor to Midday. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, Dan.
Yeah, I've given you a lot to ponder there, of course, a lot for our listeners, too. But I was struck by these events, the ACA's rebound, the rush of enrollment at the end, the Democratic president taking something of a victory lap this week, juxtaposed with one of the Republicans' young stars, Ryan, restating the party's pledge to repeal the ACA and then furthermore to cut spending on social programs for the poor. Your thoughts on this?
Well, many people have been thinking about these issues for a long time now because it's part of a pattern that's been shaping up for several years and will probably, alas, go on for several more. It's part of a pattern where in our two-party system, one of the two parties has in effect become dominated by extremists. They now control one house of Congress. Perhaps by fall they'll control both houses of Congress. And many moderate Republicans have been driven from the party or into some sort of quiet submission. These extremists are Well, their motivations are no doubt mixed, but many of them, in my view, are simply anti-government fanatics who are not only unresponsive to the needs of millions of Americans, but quite contemptuous of them. I mean, what Ryan is really after is to topple Medicare, replace it with vouchers, at which point a vested right of the elderly to good health now becomes a promise that's at the mercy of funding. Once you set up a voucher system, the funding for the vouchers can go away. And with this relentless budget-cutting imperative in the radical right, it wouldn't be very long before Americans, millions of Americans, would be absolutely on their own again, left to themselves, at the mercy of chance and disaster. Chaos, savagery. That's what these fanatics seem to want.
It's kind of hard to imagine that happening because, you know, Medicare is so is cherished by so many Americans, many Americans, older Americans, who vote. But here's what I was thinking, Richard. If people keep signing up for this, for new or improved health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act, the ACA becomes a fixed part of the nation's infrastructure, our human services infrastructure. Won't these Republicans' efforts to repeal it get old? I mean, even Tea Party members, the ones who weren't already on Medicare, might have to admit satisfaction with finally having insurance.
It's already gotten old. It's old because these people have just one stale message and they have little else to offer except for, you know, religious persecution of various kinds. But so far as government and policy is concerned, what they want is to cut government. That's all they want, that's all they know how to do, and that's all they can say. It's already old, but how it will play out is a very good question. History is hard to predict. Many commentators have said that what it takes for these Republicans to gain seats in Congress through gerrymandered districts is very different from what it will take to elect a Republican president in 2016. How much longer may divided government go on? Who can say? If some national crisis, hard to predict crisis, overtakes us, there could be a groundswell of opinion in one direction or another, and perhaps in a Democratic direction, but it's hard to say. I mean, there are things that liberals and Democrats can perhaps do to begin changing the political landscape, but they'd, it would take a lot of thought and a lot of sustained effort.
Also this week, Richard, we heard from the Supreme Court, 5-4 ruling. The court eliminated limits, certain limits on how much money people can donate in total in one election season, in one election cycle. The ruling means that a wealthy person, a liberal or conservative donor, can give as much money as desired to federal election candidates across the country, as long as no candidate receives more than the $5,200 cap, which stays in place. So they can give as much as they want, they just have to cap out at $5,200. Now, until now, an individual donor was limited to giving up to $123,200 per election cycle. So that goes away. Your thoughts on this?
Well, again, the radical right, led in this case by Antonin Scalia and like-minded justices, are steadily pushing, you know, to see how much they can get away with, how far they can push things. In this case, push things further in the direction where super wealthy donors like the Koch brothers, who have heavily bankrolled the Tea Party, can continue to spend ever greater amounts of money to dominate the airwaves, dominate through propaganda the course of American elections. There's a movement in state legislatures, including Maryland's General Assembly right now, to use Article 5 of the Constitution and call upon Congress to summon a convention to draft a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision, and this movement will probably expand itself to overturn this week's decision as well. Once two-thirds of the legislatures vote to do that, Congress has to call the convention. There are a number of constitutional amendments that are in order, I think, right now. This is one of them.
Hmm. You know, these are ideas, or actually laws, that have been in place for 100 years. I mean, going back to the Progressive Era, the idea that too much money, especially money from corporations, is corrupting in our system, that you can have, that there must be limits, and that money was not seen as a form of expression, or you know, first protected by the First Amendment, that Congress could and local state legislatures could put in limits on this. So all this seems to be breaking away.
For the last couple of generations, the radical right has been working sedulously and vigorously over time to turn back the historical clock as much as they can and put us back into the condition of the Gilded Age, where a gross amount of wealth inequality prevailed, where a wealthy elite did tend to call the shots, middle class was struggling, and the poor were quite desperate. It seems to be something that many wealthy people seem to want. No matter how much wealth they have, it's never enough. They don't want to be taxed at all. They want their wealth to be an elite counterpoint to the misery and suffering of many other people. Why is that? Are they megalomaniacs? I don't know. Fortunately, not all the wealthy are like that, but some of them certainly are.
Richard, thank you very much. Nice to hear from you again.
Good to be with you, Dan.
Richard Striner, professor of history at Washington College, and he joins us from time to time to lend historical perspective to current events. I have some listener mail I want to catch up on here at this moment in the show. I have two letters from listeners that I have here in my hands relate to the Affordable Care Act and the sign up for it here in Maryland. Kevin writing in to say, a few weeks ago, I signed up for insurance on Maryland's website. It was easy to navigate. The process took no more than a half an hour for me. Several days later, my insurance card arrived in the mail. I found the process smooth and easy. I am 57, unemployed, and I got Medicaid. Aha, Medicaid. That's the easy part. I would note here from my reporting, I've learned that that's the easy part in terms of sign up. The difficulty was in finding a subsidized private plan through the Marketplace Exchange. Ryan wrote in to thank Peter Bielenson, Dr. Peter Bielenson, now the CEO of Evergreen Health. He says, for establishing a truly different healthcare company and bringing Dr. Sharma to Baltimore. I had my first physical on Monday and was wowed by every step of the process. Yesterday, we discussed alternative energy companies and variable rate contracts for home and business heating with Paula Carmody, Maryland People's Council. Michelle wrote in to say that I have a fixed rate contract with Constellation Energy. However, the last 2 months, my son, who lives off campus at one of the Maryland colleges, complained about very high energy prices. Since I don't know who his provider is, I just chalked it up to colder than average winter weather. However, I now will check to see if one of these mentioned energy companies that's under investigation is behind the very high rates. And there's more information about that on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. We followed up yesterday. You can go to Paula Carmody's website, the Maryland People's Council website, to look up those companies that are a subject of inquiry by the Public Service Commission. Kevin wrote in comments about Douglas Gansler, the Maryland Attorney General, who was our guest yesterday on Midday, a candidate for governor in the June 24th Democratic primary. Kevin says, go figure, teens drinking in a house at the beach. This will have zero effect on who I vote for. Focusing on the negative all the time versus what Mr. Gansler or any other politician has accomplished just doesn't work for me. Kathy wrote in from Owings Mills to note this. Douglas Gansler, who was quite a good lacrosse player in college and continues to play lacrosse at the age of 50. I believe he's 50 years old. Kathy wrote in to say that my daughter plays on the Charm City Lacrosse League, which was founded by Douglas Gansler. The Charm City Lacrosse League is a nonprofit organization that provides lacrosse skills training, league play, and mentoring to underserved Baltimore City youth at no cost. The league provides recreational enrichment, builds leadership skills, teaches good sportsmanship, offers valuable positive social interaction. Every practice closes with a celebrity speaker, sometimes a Ravens player, one time Freeman Hrabowski, the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. A terrific league. I don't know what happened with Doug Gansler and his son's senior week down at the beach, but for his commitment to Baltimore City youth, with the Charm City Lacrosse League, I am voting for Doug Gansler. That's our email catch-up for today for the weekly review. If you have emails, comments you want to send along to us to be read on the air, midday@wypr.org is our midday email address. Our phone number is 410-662-8777. 8-0. Should President Obama give a pardon to Jonathan Pollard? When we come back, the Jonathan Pollard spy case. It surfaces from time to time, and this week Pollard's fate appeared to be tied to Secretary of State John Kerry's efforts to save the frayed Israel-Palestine peace talks. Should President Obama grant Pollard clemency? Kenneth Lassen thinks so. The University of Baltimore law professor joins us after this short break. And welcome back to Midday and the Weekly Review. Dan Rodericks here, joined now by Kenneth Lassen, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, and one of the Pollard activists who has tried to summon support for Jonathan Pollard's release from American political leaders. Welcome to Midday, Professor Lassen. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
The Jonathan Pollard case. This takes us back to the mid-1980s. I just want to start with some basic facts, the history of this case for our listeners who need a Pollock primer, so to speak. So this is an espionage case that goes back, as I said, to the mid-1980s when Jonathan Pollard was a civilian employee in naval intelligence. So what did the government accuse him of?
Actually, he was formally charged with one count of passing classified information to an allied foreign government during peacetime, which and there was no charge that he had any intent to harm the United States.
What exactly was he alleged to have done? He took documents from his place of work. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, he wasn't. He admitted to this. He took documents from his place of work. It was actually he made a total of 12 handoffs of documents, classified information that Israel was supposed to get under agreements between Israel and the United States, intelligence and defense information, and it wasn't getting because of some animus between the State Department and the Defense Department and Israel just at the time. So he took it upon himself wrongly, I think. He took it upon himself to right that situation, and he violated the law.
As you said, he admitted to this. There was a plea bargain, right? There was never a trial where evidence was presented.
That's correct. He was never tried. Both the government and Pollard entered into what's formally called a plea agreement, wherein, in return for Pollard's full cooperation, the government agreed not to ask for a heavy sentence. And Pollard fully cooperated. That's in the record. The government did not. The government reneged on its agreement.
In what way? You mean the government recommended a heavier sentence?
No, the government actually didn't recommend a heavier sentence, but it didn't object when the sentencing judge admitted into evidence an out-of-court and ex parte declaration by then-Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. It didn't object at all. Weinberger called Pollard the worst traitor in history, which was actually incorrect because he was never charged with treason. And there's ample evidence it was hardly the worst traitor in history. Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen were charged with treason and likewise got life sentences.
That's very interesting about Caspar Weinberger. He was Secretary of Defense, right?
Yes,
at the time. And the judge who was about to sentence Jonathan Pollard received this confidential or classified memo from the Secretary of Defense.
Which Pollard's lawyers have never been able to see to this day. They've been trying to see it.
So that provided quite an influence on the judge, apparently.
It obviously influenced the judge because he summarily threw out the plea agreement, which judges have the power to do. A lot of people don't understand that. And the plea bargain arrangement, which often happens in prosecutions and government, would never take place if it happened frequently. But the judge has the power to throw out the plea agreement. He was influenced by this document. That's in the record, and he sentenced Pollard to life in prison, which is by far the harshest sentence ever meted out for a similar offense. The average sentence is 2 to 4 years.
I have a question about Pollard and his motivations because I've done some reading about it. I remember this case when it first came up, and had to go back and refresh my memory about a few things. But it seems to me, this is an impression I have, and I'd like to hear yours, that some believe, and I remember having this impression at the time, that this was all about making money for himself and others. Once upon a time, espionage was carried out by patriots, martyrs, and ideologues. Jonathan Pollock seemed to be this new kind of spy, you know, sort of perfect for the get mine, greedy 1980s, in it for the money. At least that was the impression I was left with. And I think there was some evidence that the information that he was passing along to the Israelis could benefit some people financially. What about that? You've been through all this, so what do you think about
that? Yes, I've been through it many times. Yeah. Your impression is the impression received by many people in the public, and it's largely due to misinformation that the government has promulgated, or various spokespeople in and out of the government, those who dislike Pollard and what he did. In fact, Pollard acted as an ideologue and not as a mercenary. The FBI itself conducted something like 9 months' worth of polygraph tests, and it itself concluded that Pollard was an ideologue and not a mercenary. Had he been a mercenary, had he taken the sums that they claim he took, which are absolutely ridiculous, $300,000, whatever, he did receive sums for expenses. But had he taken those sums as a mercenary, then the judge could have and probably would have fined him. The judge didn't do that.
Why did the government take such a strong view on this, an attitude toward Pollard at the time of his trial, and then even after that, for years after that, through the Clinton administration, when there might have been an opportunity there? President Clinton, I think, for a time considered clemency for him. But you
that's
know,
a saga in itself, because Clinton had actually promised Prime Minister Netanyahu that of Israel at the Y plantation discussions that he would release Pollard, and the president didn't do that. That's in the record on both sides of the ocean.
And I think some officials in our government even warned the president not to do it, and some even threatened to resign if he did.
Well, the story is that George Tenet, who was then
the
head of the CIA, threatened to resign. There's some he later said he never did that, never threatened to resign. But there was a lot of talk, as there still is today, that Pollard should rot in jail. He should never be released. And this animus towards Pollard, now I'm in the realm of speculation because I don't know this. I usually deal in facts.
Right.
And what I gave you before were facts on the record. But the animus towards Pollard, I think, was in large part because of the mistakes made by the State Department and the intelligence community as to the damage that Russia and other foreign governments who were not allies of the United States were receiving. Pollard never compromised any American lives. This was a story that was concocted by the government and is still out there. But the real culprits were Ames and Hansen and a few others, and they're the ones who did compromise American lives. The intelligence community didn't want to admit this at the time, and there's still people, elements in the intelligence community and the State Department that don't want to see Pollard free.
Kenneth Lassen is our guest, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, an advocate for the release of Jonathan Pollard from federal prison. The question I had for you next had to do with, you argue for his release, that President Obama has the power to grant clemency to Jonathan Pollard. Your reasons for that are primarily because of the sentence. You think the sentence is grossly disproportionate to others who have committed similar offenses?
As I said earlier, the average sentence for a similar crime is 2 to 4 years, and many people don't serve that much time. Pollard has been in prison for close to 30 years now. This is his 29th year in prison as part of a life sentence. And there's been a lot of pressure against successive presidents, from Clinton through Bush, George W. Bush, to President Obama, to grant clemency, not to pardon him, but to grant clemency. At this point, all of his appeals have been exhausted, and the only person who has the right and the power to grant clemency is the President of the United States, who, by the way, has pardoned far fewer people than any president in recent history in the past 100 years.
I read that. In fact, last year when you wrote an op-ed on this subject that was published in the Baltimore Sun, I think the number was 23. President Obama had only granted 23 pardons?
Yes, and that's
compared
far
to
fewer
other
than
presidents.
Far fewer.
Far fewer. So is Jonathan Pollard eligible for parole?
He is technically eligible for parole, but the fact is that he wouldn't likely get it. The intelligence community and the State Department has come out against his parole. And although he could apply for parole, it would be kind of a charade. The feeling in the Pollard camp, and I share this feeling, is that Pollard's best bet is to get clemency from the president. We don't think, at least I don't think, and I think that a lot of people share this view, that Pollard should be held hostage to the peace negotiations, as he apparently is currently. I think that's immoral. The reason Pollard should be freed is not because he's innocent of the offense, but because the sentence is so grossly disproportionate. It's an aberration of American justice. That's why I'm in the case. I've mentioned this many times. I've used this phrase. If he were a Chinese Irishman who were subjected to the same behavior by the government, I'd feel the same way. The government of the United States usually works. The system usually works. In this case, it hasn't.
I've read numerous commentary this week, Professor Lassen, expressing the view that tying the Pollard case to these ongoing Israel-Palestine negotiations is foolish, that it will actually make no difference.
I think it's virtually irrelevant at this point. The negotiations are so shaky, as you know, from this week's events. But at the same time, you know, we in the Pollard camp, I've been working on this case for 25 years, and I will continue working until he gets out. It seems to me that this is the right thing to do. And he should have been let out a long time ago. So I think that this is just this itself is a play that's in fact is immoral. The president shouldn't be engaging in this kind of playmaking. But at the same time, we would accept, or Pollard himself would accept, this as a gesture towards the Israelis, who are our allies, to continue with the peace talks.
A question from one of our listeners, Professor Lassen. This is from Charlotte, who wants to know, who's curious why he was not charged with treason.
Is it because treason is a technical term, constitutional definition. Treason is consorting with the enemy during wartime. So the word traitor is loosely thrown around by a lot of people, including people in and out of the government. And Pollard is certainly not technically a traitor. People could say that Baltimore people who root for the Yankees are traitors, but this is a much looser construction of the term. He's not a traitor.
Well, that gets me to my next question, and it takes us back to what the official charge was against Jonathan Pollard that you mentioned at the outset, providing
classified information to an ally during peacetime.
Yeah. See, this is what might strike a lot of people as strange, is we're keeping a man in prison for life for providing information to an ally. And are you convinced that Pollard knew what he was doing, that he knew that there was a gap in information between the U.S., intelligence between the U.S. and Israel, and that he might be filling that by providing these documents?
I'm absolutely convinced of that. And I've looked at the facts, and Pollard, while some people call him a mercenary, did this for the ideological reason of supplying Israel with information that it had been entitled to by virtue of a number of executive agreements.
How did you get drawn into this case? You say you've been on it for 25 years, longtime law professor at the University of Baltimore here. And we know Jonathan Pollard operated in Maryland. His job was, I think one of his positions was in Suitland, Maryland.
Yes.
At a facility there. I don't know where he lived. Did he actually live in Maryland?
Yes, I think he did. Well, he may have lived in Washington, D.C. I just don't know.
I've
spoken to him many times on the phone. Mm-hmm. I've never met him personally for personal choice, because I'm looking to justify the principle of American justice here. And that's why I've been in it from the beginning. It's just unfair. The more I looked at this, the more I noticed it's unfair. I've been involved in other cases where I've detected unfairness. This is a gross unfairness.
Well, you say you've been on the case for 25 years, which to me says you noticed unfairness early on.
Way back when. At the time the government entered into a plea bargain and then it was refused by the judge, I was just wondering, as a layman law professor, so to speak, how the judge could do this, what influenced them. And the more I looked into it, the more unfair I saw it was. And in fact, on one of the appeals in which I worked, and I sent an amicus brief on behalf of other law professors who were similarly concerned, it was a three-judge panel, and the two of the three judges, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, found Pollard's sentence to be not to be just. It was his appeal was not allowed on procedural grounds. The one judge who didn't in the D.C. Court of Appeals, the one non-Jewish judge, as it happened to be, said that this was a gross miscarriage of American justice. That was Judge Stephen Williams way back in 1993 or so.
The New York Times has a story in the paper today about American Jews. The headline is, "Talk of freeing a spy for Israel stirs old unease for U.S. Jews." And I was interested in this story. I got to a paragraph here I want to read to you and then get your thoughts on it. For an older generation, the potential release of this Cold War-era spy, Jonathan Pollard, has roused another unwelcome ghost from the past, the suggestion that American Jews, like Mr. Pollard, inevitably hold divided loyalties and cannot be trusted in sensitive posts.
I'm particularly offended by that, not only because it comes from the New York Times, which has been unfair towards Israel and toward Pollard for many years, in my opinion, but I happen to be Jewish, and I have no dual loyalty. I certainly respect Israel. I'm an American. I respect America. I love America, and I think it's a great country, and that's all the more reason why we should pursue fairness and justice. But among the many people in and out of the government who have come to Pollard's defense and have said that this is an unfair sentence are a lot of non-Jews, including former secretaries of state like George Shultz, of course Henry Kissinger is Jewish, Michael Hayden, who was a former head of the CIA, as was James Woolsey, and
it's quite a long list.
Senator
now.
John McCain, Lawrence Gorb, mm-hmm. a lot of people, most recently Dennis Ross. So there are a lot of people who share my view that this is an aberration and should be corrected. The president has the right and the power to do that.
Alan Dershowitz has worked on this case as well over the years. He was on our show about a month or so ago, quoting Alan Dershowitz here. "Everyone seems frightened to speak up on behalf of a convicted spy. This has been especially true of the Jewish leadership in America. The Pollards are Jewish. The Pollards are also Zionists who, out of a sense of misguided racial imperative," and that's in quotes because that's quoting Jonathan Pollard, "seem to place their commitment to Israeli survival over the laws of their own country. American Jewish leaders, always sensitive to the canard of dual loyalty, are keeping a low profile on the Pollard matter. Many American Jews at the grassroots are outraged at what they perceive to be an overreaction to Pollard's crimes and the unusually long sentence imposed on Jonathan Pollard." Now, he did write that a few years ago.
Professor Dershowitz and I agree on this. We are acquaintances, and we agree on that, except that more recently, most of the American Jewish establishment has come out strongly in favor of a release for Pollard on humanitarian grounds and on fairness grounds. But originally, they didn't at all, and I think that that's shameful. For my own part, I never mentioned the word anti-Semitism for the first 10 or 15 years that I was involved in the case. And now I see nothing but anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism, which conflate, the two are conflated nowadays. And it seems to me that there's a strong element of this and all the more reason for justice to be served here.
What's the downside for President Obama in granting clemency to Jonathan Pollard? He doesn't have to pardon him. He can grant him clemency.
I don't see the downside. I've written a number of op-eds, as you suggest, saying that there's no downside for him, except maybe the animus of his intelligence community. But, most of the people in the intelligence community now were very young. They certainly weren't in the CIA at the time that Pollard was originally caught and sentenced. So what's the problem? It's a real puzzlement to me as to why the president doesn't exercise this simple power to achieve justice.
Professor Lassen, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Lassen is professor of law at the University of Baltimore and one of the Jonathan Pollard activists who has tried to summon support for Jonathan Pollard's release from American political leaders. You can read an essay written by Professor Lassen on this subject on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
One more break on the weekly review, then it's all about the birds coming up in our last segment of this hour. Where to see the Baltimore Orioles in action and how to attract them to your yard. We'll be right back. Still ahead in Midday's second hour, Frank Capra called her the greatest emotional actress the screen has yet known. Her biographer, Victoria Wilson, tells us about Barbara Stanwyck. And Midday film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed join us for an hour-long appreciation of an actress whose career spans 60 years in movies and television. Barbara Stanwyck and her greatest roles in must-see movies, Midday on Film with DeLibero and Reed, after the news at 1. And welcome back to the Midday Weekly Review. Coming up on the Monday Midday Show, The Quest for a Healthy Life, science writer Donna Jackson Nakazawa tells the story of her efforts to overcome a chronic illness and find her joy again. Really interesting book she's written on that. And then in the second hour, it's more Midday on Health. Dr. John Smarr will be with us again, along with Dr. Zachary Berger, a researcher at Johns Hopkins who studies communications between doctors and their patients. A conversation about how to talk to your doc in the second hour of our show on Monday. After dropping 2 out of 3 games to the Boston Red Sox at Camden Yards, the Orioles now are off to Detroit for the weekend to play the Tigers. And while the baseball birds are away, what's up with the real Baltimore Orioles, the ones with feathers? Where and when might we see its orange and black flash in Maryland this spring? I mean, is it possible to attract Orioles even to your backyard? We hope to get answers to those questions in this segment of Midday Friday. But first, our guests want to speak about an interesting project related to birds that's going on at Patterson Park in southeast Baltimore. The park serves as an important stopover for migratory birds this time of year, and the Patterson Park Audubon Center is building bird habitat there. So we welcome to the show Susie, how do you pronounce your last name? It's C-R-E-A-M-E-R. I didn't even ask you.
Creamer.
It is Creamer.
Yes.
Because I've seen that pronounced Kramer, too.
That's what they tell me.
Yeah. Susie Creamer, who is Director of Urban Education and Conservation for the Patterson Park Audubon Center. I didn't even know we had one. It's great to have you here. Hello, Susie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. And Dave Kirsten is joining us again. Actually, he's rejoining us. We welcome Dave back to Midday. He is the Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, Maryland, D.C. Dave, nice to have you with us, too.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be back.
Yeah. So you're going to fill us in on the Oriole a little bit later on, too. And I'll tell you why I asked this question today. But, Susie, tell us about, first of all, the Audubon Center at Patterson Park. And do birds really know about Patterson Park? This is kind of cool. It's a stopover in their migration. But first, tell us about the Audubon Center, what you've been doing there.
Sure. Patterson Park Audubon Center is an educational center of the National Audubon Society. It's one of only 2 in Maryland and the only one in Baltimore, and we're very proud to be in Patterson Park. We lead environmental education, bird conservation, and community development programs with beautiful Patterson Park as our classroom. We engage school groups and the community in learning about birds, but also in building bird habitat in the park. So we have programs for all ages, but a lot of it is centered more and more around increasing the bird habitat in Patterson Park. So we have our gardens, and we love volunteers to help us with those.
How long have you been doing this in Patterson Park?
The Audubon Center has been there for about 12 years. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I mean, you have an office there?
We have an office across from the park on the northeast corner of the park, just above a restaurant called Bistro RX. So it's not a center where you'd pop in and see what's going on, and we have exhibits. We use Patterson Park as our classroom.
I posted some photographs that you sent us.
Thank you.
And one shows a garden, lots of plants going on there. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the birds. You've attracted birds to Patterson Park, or were birds already coming to Patterson Park before you started doing this?
I don't think we can take full credit for the birds in the park. But Patterson Park is an urban oasis, so in the middle of a very built-up Baltimore and urbanized East Coast, we have 193 species of birds alone on record having visited Patterson Park. It surprises even avid birders. And so our gardens enhance more and more the habitat that's offered for a rest and refuel on their long migratory journeys. So we plant strategically, selecting plants that either feed the birds directly or that feed bugs, insects that are food for birds.
Yeah. So of those 193, some of this is really interesting to me because I'm kind of a bird nut. But anyway, birds. So birds stop at Patterson Park, but don't spend the year in Maryland. These are birds that really do dwell for most of the spring and summer up north somewhere.
They are. The bulk of them are. There are year-round residents, and I might turn to Dave to give more specifics.
For instance,
I'm just curious
about who would be the most far-flung of the birds. Like, which ones would spend the spring and summer in Canada, for instance, or even up New England?
A lot of them would spend the summer up in the boreal forests of Canada and New England. It's an incredible diversity, 193 species in a small urban park. And the vast majority of those are migrants. So we see them in the spring and again in the fall as they pass through. And the reason they're drawn to Patterson Park is because if you go to an aerial photo, you'll see just how dense the urban environment is around it. It's all gray and concrete. And then you've got this square of green. And in that square of green, you have scattered trees. And you have the pond with some vegetation around the pond. You have little bits of habitat for forest birds, for shrubland birds, for water birds. And they just make a beeline for it. If they're tired, you can have an amazing time there.
I could see that if I was doing a flyover looking for a green spot. That's probably the biggest one I would see from my bird's eye view, right? So, Dave, can you name a bird that's like gets you excited because you know this bird, he or she is only going to be here for a few days, maybe on their way to someplace. They won't spend the year here, in other words.
I think the birds that get the bird watchers excited the most are some of the water birds, some of the marsh birds that come through. American bittern is one.
American bittern?
Yeah, it's a secretive, brown, streaky bird that lives in really big marshes. But when it's migrating, it will be found in the park. And we have less than half an acre of wetland there. And in April and May, most years you can see one or two there. So that's really remarkable to be able to see a bird which is so elusive and lives in such wild places. And in the park, it's highly visible. And this is true for all of the birds, the forest birds, because the trees are widely spaced. So Patterson Park is a really good place to see birds. And we have bird watchers coming in from the county and other counties to join us on our bird field trips.
And when do you do that, Susie? I mean, I guess this is a good time of year to be doing it. So do you set up birding days or events for people to attend? And also, you know, keep in mind, people who may be curious about this and have always wanted to do it might be listening and wondering, when can I go to do that?
Yeah, and all are welcome. You don't have to be an expert birder to join us. We have them twice monthly year-round, so not just during migration. They tend to be second Fridays and last Saturdays. There are a couple exceptions, but on pattersonpark.audubon.org, our website, you should be able to find, hot off the press, our newest program postcard, which is 3 months at a glance.
Okay.
And that should be up today, if not very soon.
So what do? You actually like set up a line, a viewing area with binoculars, or are people just free to roam with I guess people know what they're doing or what they're looking for.
Well,
what about people who don't? And maybe want to get started or bring a son or daughter.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's welcome. And we do have binoculars to lend people. So they just need to drop us an email or give us a call in advance. Again, that contact information is on the website. But wonderful people like Dave are the leaders, experts in identifying these birds, including the short visiting migrants. We meet and walk together is what we do. So we meet near the fountain. If you know the park, it's in the northwest corner of the park near the pagoda.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of wander our way down past the community gardens, through some scattered trees to the boat lake, which is often a good finish, and then up to the Audubon Gardens for the real finale.
One of the photographs you sent me was of an old canoe that's now, full of plant life, right? So where is that canoe? Is it near the pond?
It's actually across the street from the park at the Patterson Park Public Charter School. It's one of our partner schools, and I've been working with a parent group of Latino women there, and so they planted habitat in the canoe. They painted it all around, a Four Seasons colorful theme.
It's
and
bird habitat?
So it's bird habitat. So the
birds
idea
go there
is
to find what? Bugs?
Well, yeah, mostly bugs is what it would be. But the idea is that at home, too, even if you have a completely paved lot, you can plant in a few planters and put your patch in the patchwork quilt of habitat throughout Baltimore. And so no matter how small, we like everyone to take a role in having that impact. So the canoe is just a clever way to do that.
I get you. So, and there's certain plants that you plant that may attract birds,
mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly.
And do you have that information too available? Not today, but I mean, is
we
it on
do.
Your...
We have top 10 lists of herbaceous plants, of shrubs, and of trees. So okay. Top 10s of each that are best for attracting wildlife.
Dave, is that, by the way, that bitten that gets you excited, do you count on seeing those bittens each year?
Yeah, the last
pretty
two
much...
or 3 years, they have been there each year. Yeah, and not only an American bitten, but a least bitten. And so last year, bird watchers were seeing those two at the same time. But we also get an amazing variety of forest birds, orioles, of course, I'll talk about those in a minute, but tanagers and vireos and warblers. The warblers
you
were really colorful.
You have a scarlet tanager?
We do. We have scarlet tanagers.
They come
through Patterson Park, and sometimes you can hear two or three of them singing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in May at Patterson Park, you can actually get a kind of a preview of what the Canadian boreal forest sounds like, because quite a few of the birds are right there singing their hearts out on migration. They're all pumped full of testosterone, and so they're giving it everything they can.
I want to spend a few minutes talking about the Baltimore Oriole, because you know, we have the Birds of Baltimore, our baseball team, but I don't know if anybody ever takes a moment to think about the real thing, or you know, have I ever seen one? I've seen one once. When can I see it again? What's the story on the Baltimore Oriole in Maryland?
Well, the Baltimore Oriole in Maryland, its range is here, so they nest here. And the habitat they really like is riparian woodland. So sycamore trees and other tall trees along watercourses. They really like that kind of habitat.
They like to
structure.
Be near a river?
They like to be near a little stream if they can. And you can see them each year in Patterson Park. So they migrate through. And some years, one or two pairs will actually stay to nest, which seems remarkable, but they certainly
and
do.
And they have an extraordinary nest. The Baltimore Oriole, I held one in my hand once, and I was amazed. It was like a little sack or a purse that a woman might take to the opera with her or something like that.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
They're very intricate. They actually, it's a woven basket of grass, and they suspend it from the tips of tree twigs. And so it's very, very beautiful. And
The one I had in my hands was so soft. It was almost like coarse silk. I couldn't believe it. There's a lot of horsehair in it, too.
Yeah, horsehair, and on the lining, they can sometimes use spider's webs and soft materials like that. So
are you saying if we keep our eyes open, and even in Patterson Park in Baltimore, we might see a Baltimore Orioles maybe even nest some years?
Yeah, absolutely. They're coming back soon. So maybe unlike the Baltimore Oriole baseball team,
yeah.
These Orioles are coming back in just a couple of weeks. And they will be the last couple of weeks in April is the time to really see them.
Okay. So. And what about your backyard? What about attracting Orioles to the backyard? I know folks might be curious about that. I've posted a lot of photographs of Orioles recently on my Facebook page because I think they're so beautiful, and I love to see them more often than I do. So what about the backyard, Susie?
I would recommend planting plants that feed caterpillars. So not just the beautiful adult butterflies, but the caterpillars, which are important food during the nesting time, since they do nest here to feed them and to feed their young. So during migration, they prefer really ripe fruits, very juicy, overly ripe, dark-colored fruits. But when they come to stay and come to nest, so planting the right plants, as opposed to putting out sort of artificial man-made food for them, we really, really recommend recreating those natural environments by having all these Maryland native plants that'll feed the bugs that feed the birds.
So instead of a dish of grape jelly or
right.
putting out oranges, I mean, putting out oranges is okay to attract
right.
them, but you're
right.
saying if you want to keep them around,
yeah.
these plants that produce caterpillars.
Because you'll right. also help other birds, not just the orioles.
Yeah. Now, we have the Oriole song here. These songs were recorded in Maryland, one in 1990, another one way back in 1958. I don't know that I've ever heard this myself, but this is good. Let's listen to a little bit of this. This is what a Baltimore Oriole sounds like. Have you heard that, Dave?
Yeah, they sing in the park on migration. It's a really melodious sound. There's a few other birds that sound similar, so it can be a little bit tricky to pick them out.
That was a recording from 1998, and we have a separate recording, the one that was from the 1950s here in Maryland. That, folks, is what a Baltimore Oriole sounds like. It's pretty neat. All right. Yeah, thank you. I want to go. I want to hear that myself. You think maybe in a couple of weeks in Patterson Park, maybe.
The last bird walk in April is the time, which is the 26th.
Mm-hmm. 26th yeah. is a one of your walks
Saturday,
in Patterson
8
Park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
come and join us.
Dave Kirsten, who is the director of bird conservation for Audubon Maryland D.C., and Susie Creamer, director of urban education and conservation for the Patterson Park Audubon Center, have been our guests here in this last segment of Midday. More information on the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page and the Facebook page of the Audubon Center at Patterson Park. Thank you very much. Thanks both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, folks. That's our first hour for Midday. We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us today by Joe's Squared. Joe's Squared, family-owned and offers coal-fired pizza and 17 types of risotto. We'll see you soon.